Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hotman, and here we are once again. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here to commemorate our weekly Q&A with Layla, and it's an opportunity for you to pose your questions. Your questions can come to us via this email address, radioprogram@AOL.com, and we receive many questions, and we endeavor to answer them as expeditiously as possible. Today with me is our nutritionist in residence, who is Layla Mudin. She's a registered dietitian. She also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition and also claims the distinction of having been a nutritionist working with the late Dr. Robert Atkins during the latter years of his career. Mm. Not to date you, because, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all right.
It's all right. You know, if you were there from, you know, with him from the beginning, then that might be dating you.
Actually, I wasn't there long enough, in my opinion. I got there in the winter of the year that he passed away, unfortunately. I almost feel like I got there in the nick of time or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he certainly, you know, had a background in low-carb nutrition.
Yeah.
And that was formative for you after years of conventional indoctrination that saturated fat was the culprit and cholesterol was bad and so on and so on.
Right.
And then you saw daily miracles at the Atkins Center.
Oh, my goodness.
And now have been with us for well over 10 years. That's correct, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have in the news an article that you wrote entitled Layla Weighs In, Does Inflammation Increase the Likelihood of Mental Illness? Well, does it?
Well, that was a very interesting study, and they used a mouse model. In a lot of autoimmunity, the inflammation associated with, and they're talking specifically about lupus, may translate to cytokines crossing the blood-brain barrier, which is supposed to be very, very selective. So it's really
what's supposed to keep the bad stuff out.
Exactly.
Right.
So those with lupus or other autoimmune neurological conditions are also having psychoses, psychotic events. They're having seizure. They're having depression. Of course, the depression can be about
their
health status.
Not feeling well.
Or reacting to medication or anything like that. But I just found it... It's interesting to me that I don't know whether it's because everything's become more medicalized or there's more diagnoses now in the DSMs that there's more diagnosis of mental illness. Mm-hmm. 1 out of 5, I think, is the latest statistic.
I say 1 out of 4 women have or are taking antidepressants.
Yeah.
But coming back to this theme, it kind of squares with the observation that there was a study that showed that curcumin was helpful in the treatment of depression. And so we're beginning to look at depression as an inflammatory disorder of the brain.
Yes.
And, you know, one has only to look at a condition where the body generates a lot of cytokines that's familiar to us all.
Yeah.
When we have a bad cold or the flu, it really gets us down. We really feel gloomy and our mental outlook is changed.
Yes.
We may have difficulty with sleep. We may have inability to move around, lack of motivation. And that's part of the cytokine storm that affects the body in response to infection or in autoimmunity. So there's also a high degree of depression associated with rheumatoid arthritis, for example. So clearly, you know, depression, you know, life circumstances, good talk therapy is important, cognitive behavioral therapy.
It's holistic because our brains are in this body.
Right. So we you know, we want to look at it not just as a neurotransmitter imbalance, which can be tweaked with the latest, greatest, you know, Lexapro or whatever agent that modifies the neurotransmitters. Or alternatively, from a holistic standpoint or integrative standpoint, using amino acids as precursors to serotonin and the catecholamines to feel good neurotransmitters, but also to combat inflammation. And we can do that through a variety of means, through diet modification, anti-inflammatory diet, through the use of anti-inflammatory nutrients.
Yes.
And we know that curcumin does get to the brain, because studies show that the people in the Indian subcontinent who consume a lot of curry that's rich in curcumin mm-hmm. have a much lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, wow.
So neurodegenerative diseases, depression.
Yes.
So that's an article that you wrote, and you can find it at drhoffman.com. That's part of your weekly contribution to our newsletter.
I find it concerning that the incidence or prevalence of mental illness has only been going up. Mm-hmm. And it may be concurrent with autoimmunity, and among other things, certainly.
Too much social media.
Too much social media. Oh, I just podcasted recently that our smartphones make us dumb.
Right. Yeah. By virtue of the fact that it's a lifeline so that we can sort of not know stuff and go to the phone for an answer, but also by virtue of distraction.
Yes.
Because it somehow takes away from our concentration to be constantly, you know, eyeing that phone for new messages or, you know.
A Canadian study actually found that the people who had even their smartphones turned down, turned off, not just silent, but off.
Right.
The fact that it was still there or in their pocket or in their pocketbook, they were still distracted.
It was present. So what leads me to a speculation that the average hunter-gatherer, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago, we think of these people as very primitive and stupid because they don't, you know, they'd show them a smartphone, they wouldn't know what to do with it. They'd probably throw it at an antelope or something. They would think it's a projectile. Uh-huh. But they had the same brains that we have. Mm-hmm. Basically, we evolved. We reached our current stage of evolution where we were Homo sapiens, the species name is thinking humans, around 50,000 years ago. And it's quite possible that they had exactly the same IQs and exactly the same intelligence that we had, but it was related to reading markers on a trail, tracking animals, looking at plants to gather them to see if they're edible, learning how to fashion stone tools that modern man finds virtually impossible. You know, they tried to recreate stone tools that people made with very simple, basically
using other stones,
using stones to make stones.
Yeah.
The chipping and the flinting of these stones requires a very high order of intelligence, training, manual dexterity. And so people, we are guilty of presentism. We think we are now the culmination of thousands of years of evolution. We're smarter than we've ever been. I don't know, maybe we're getting dumber.
Yeah, I think all that, it disturbs me. I ride the subway every day to get here and home. And there are too many people too involved with their phones to even look up to see if somebody, who's coming in, who's coming off. If there's any danger, hello, we live in New York. If you see something, say something, forget about it. They're not going to. So between that and their earbuds and watching their favorite TV shows, now it's become the new opiate.
Alternatively, listening to Intelligent Medicine. Who knows?
There you go. That's true. They could be listening to these podcasts. And or there, I'd say, carry on.
increasing your brain power.
Increasing, right.
Okay, so let's launch into questions.
Okay, well, actually, first, Dr. Hoffman, we've got a really nice note from Michael. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I want to give you and Layla a very special thank you for providing a detailed and very helpful response to a question that I emailed you regarding ways to mitigate the side effects of prednisone and the advantages of tapering off, which I had to do due to a severe asthma attack. I appreciate your well-balanced, non-ideological approach to health, nutrition, medicine, as well as your acknowledgement that all studies must be interpreted wisely.
Let's hit pause right there.
Yeah.
Non-ideological. And what I think he's referring to, and I find that the highest compliment, because intelligent medicine means stepping back, and of course we carry a certain bias towards natural approaches, but we're actually looking for correct approaches, and if we're mired in ideology, then we'll say, well, no, don't take drugs, drugs are horrible, never succumb to conventional medicine, surgery, you know, is just slashing, and so on.
Right.
And, you know, there's a slogan about conventional cancer therapy, slash burn poison. It's all slash burn poison. Well, you know, we have to acknowledge that advances are occurring in, you know, even in the cancer field where results have been so abysmal until fairly recently, that we've got to look to both ends of the medical spectrum mm-hmm. for answers and incorporate those and compatibly deploy them to the good of our patients.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, keep going.
Yeah, no, Michael, we're glad that you feel better, and thank you for taking the time to send us this note.
Okay. We love getting feedback.
All right. We have an email from Jeremy. Jeremy comes all the way from London mm-hmm. via email.
Now, I have a feeling this is by way of a complaint.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, so it's the other side of the coin.
It's the other side of the coin. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. My wife and I have been listening to your podcast for years, striking a nice balance between big pharma and totally holistic medicine. We were, however, a little disappointed with the recent review made about gallbladder and liver flushes, where I think you advised the latest research was that there was little more than olive oil and saponins, which seemed to align with your thoughts. Would be interested to learn about the thoroughness of recent research. Jeremy and his wife have had great success doing gallbladder flushes using olive oil, and they argue that that this is indeed helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And what say you, Dr. Hoffman,
okay.
to that?
Yeah. Well, I've received a bit of blowback from people who are in the, let's call it, I would say the naturopathic community, because I think the naturopathic community is also in a scientifically oriented community, especially
yes.
these days, but perhaps on the more committed fringe of the natural movement, which is opposed to conventional interventions for gallbladder, which is the surgery, of course, and utilizes this traditional liver gallbladder flush. And so, to give you a little background on this, here's a letter in The Lancet from 1999, and it appeared in The Lancet, so people often use this as substantiation for the benefits of the liver gallbladder flush in The Lancet. I've done a lot of research on this, and I've looked for any possible scientific reference to demonstrate that they work or that they don't work. And so a person writes, as a chemical engineer, I was surprised to read an article critical of the gallstone dissolution with the liver gallbladder flush. As a doctor, so he's a doctor, he's a PhD, but he's not a medical doctor, mm-hmm. I would expect erosion of the epithelial lining using these harsh chemicals that were used in this process. So he says, my wife has treated herself for gallstone. She took for 1 week 1 liter of apple juice daily, and on the seventh day, it's like biblical, on the seventh day...
she rested.
No, she didn't. She took action. She took 1 cup of olive oil just before going to bed, and then she rested. She then lay on her left side during the night. Next morning, the stones were collected in the stool. They were soft and brown. At the university hospital, they were recognized as fatty stones. For easy collection of the stones, the bowels can be cleaned by an oral dose of magnesium sulfate at noon and skipping of the evening meal on day 7. In comparison with the chemical prescription in the previous article, apple juice therapy is kinder to the human body and will have only some minor untasty side effects. So this is cited as evidence that the liver gallbladder flush works because it's in a very popular scientific medical journal. But it is a letter to the editor. And as a letter to the editor, it's not that rigorous because it says, well, you know, they went to the hospital and they said, that looks like stones. Mm. But they didn't do an analysis of the stones. So
right.
in response to this, a few years later, they did a analysis in The Lancet, the self-same medical journal. 40-year-old woman came to the outpatient clinic with a history of right-sided pain after fatty food. That's pretty typical for gallstones. Mm-hmm. And indeed, abdominal ultrasound showed multiple 1 to 2 millimeter gallstones in the gallbladder. Now, what I'll say here is this is important because in the first correspondence, in the letter to the editor, they don't say that there's radiographic evidence of gallstones. It's just that it seems that the wife who said she had gallstones or may have had gallstones or had some pain on her right side took the flush and felt better. Okay, so that's number one problem with that, you know.
I could think of another example of had a pain on my right side, had a bowel movement and felt better.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So so that's not that rigorous. But yeah. In this case, this woman had gallstones. So the woman had recently followed a liver cleansing regime on the advice of an herbalist. I guess that's the appropriate word for people who promote this. Hmm. And indeed, I'll comment later because I think there may be some benefit to the liver gallbladder flush, but not necessarily if you actually have discernible stones. The regime,
because that could cause a gallbladder attack almost.
Yeah, because yeah. it may cause the gallbladder to contract and spasm, but you could get an attack. Hmm. And maybe the stone won't be able to exit.
Right.
So free intake of apple and vegetable juice, followed by consumption of 600 milliliters of olive oil and 300 milliliters of lemon juice. There are variations on the theme. This activity resulted in the painless passage of multiple semi-solid green stones, air quote, around stones, in the early hours of the next morning. She collected them, stored them in a freezer, and presented them in a clinic. So she wanted a scientific analysis of, you know, I think these are stones. Take a look at them. Tell me what you think.
Uh-huh.
Well, they did. Microscopic examination of the patient's stones revealed that they lacked any crystalline structure. So cholesterol stones, that's crystalline. So
yeah.
That it would be, you'd see cholesterol crystals. They melted while they were in the freezer. Then they melted after 10 minutes at 40 degrees centigrade. That's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
They contained no cholesterol, bilirubin, or calcium. And what they had in them were mostly oleic acid, which is the major component of olive oil. And if you mix olive oil with lemon juice, it's like a little kitchen chemistry.
Salad dressing.
Well, yeah. But in fact, what you get is you get a little sort of a beading.
Mm-hmm.
But especially
within it, yes.
If you add a little bit of base, I guess that's simulating what happens with the flush.
Mm-hmm.
On air drying at room temperature, these balls became quite solid and hard. But they're actually soap balls. They're like a form of soap. And in fact, that's called saponification.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's how... Our ancestors, our frontier ancestors, used to make soap. They used to take ash, which is alkaline, mm-hmm. and they used to take some animal oil, you know, animal fat like mm-hmm. tallow,
mm-hmm.
and then they would make soap. They put some fragrance in it, and they would make their own soap, and that's how you make soap. So the Lancet article, it's a scientific analysis of the stone, says these green stones... resulted from the action of gastric lipases on the simple and mixed triacylglycerols that make up olive oil, yielding long-chain carboxylic acids.
Uh-huh.
Those are authentic New York sounds in the background.
That's right.
Mainly oleic acid. And this process was followed by saponification of large and soluble micelles, which are called soapstones.
Okay.
Soapstones. Okay, so now, clearly something's happening when you do this, and there is a condition where you don't actually have stones, where you have a sluggish gallbladder,
so and there's sludge.
You have sludge, and sludge is a precursor to stones, and maybe, just maybe, someone who has sludge might expel some bile via this method, and this might be a way to prevent stones. But if you actually have stones, sizable stones, I don't think there's evidence that that you actually somehow cause the gallbladder to open and allow passage through the very narrow bile duct into the intestine, and they're expelled. I just don't.
That could cause a medical emergency. Taking that much olive oil if you have large gallstones.
Right.
You're advised to follow a low carb diet so your gallbladder doesn't contract.
Right.
And cause that kind of discomfort.
So now I also know that. One of the things that the late Dr. Nick Gonzalez recommended as a cleanse, in addition to coffee enemas,
was
which
we talked about last week.
A variation on this liver on this liver flush. He called it a liver flush, not a gallbladder flush, but a liver flush. And there is some evidence that say you're detoxifying, you know, maybe you're detoxifying from chemical exposure, maybe you're detoxifying from chemo, maybe you're detoxifying as you undergo the Gonzales protocol to, in effect, dissolve away your tumors. And the body goes through a process where it tries to eliminate some of these waste products, and it's possible that that is helpful at facilitating detoxification via the intestinal tract. I will, that much I will concede, and therefore I wouldn't say that this procedure is total quackery and without value. I'm just thinking, if you have gallstones, I just don't see any scientific evidence, nor do I have the experience to demonstrate that if you your stones disappear when this happens. And so again, in the letter that we got here, we're not seeing an analysis, a chemical analysis of the stones. We're not seeing before and after right upper quadrant ultrasounds that show, I want to demonstrate. I'm treating, you know, I treated five patients. Here's before and after on five patients. They were full of gallstones. They did the procedure. And now look at their gallbladders. They're clear of stones. Right. I'm not seeing that kind of level of evidence. Now, I am open. If someone out there in this vast audience of ours is a practicing herbalist who is undertaking a more rigorous scientific approach to their practice and can demonstrate to me that there is that kind of before and after, then I'll, you know, I'm open. I'm open. I just I haven't seen
we'd
it.
We'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I would love to stand corrected on this, because it's a important element in some naturopathic detoxification regimens.
Yeah.
I just don't think it makes stones go away. I wish I could talk to Nick Gonzales, you know, in the hereafter and ask his opinion. I used to interview him frequently on my podcasts, but he is no longer available as a resource on this.
Jeremy, thank you for your very thoughtful question and comments.
And also think, Jeremy, I you know, I would encourage you. I think you're doing good in your practice of naturopathic medicine in England. So I'm sure many many Brits are beneficiaries of your good offices.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for your email.
And thanks for listening. All right. We generally pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. So Layla, fast forward to part two. Tell us what we're going to be tackling in part two.
What is your opinion of the shingles vaccine?
Okay. We're going to talk about the shingles vaccine in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin, our nutritionist, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla.